You're listening to the Arsenal for Democracy, forging and preparing a new generation for leadership. Now, here's your host, Bill Humphrey.
For 91.3 FM WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark in the great state of Delaware, I'm Bill Humphrey, and thanks for listening. I'm coming to you on October 26th, 2014, from my studio in Newton, Massachusetts. This week, Nate joins me to discuss bad media coverage of Nigeria. Then we talk about the threat of the Mexican cartel's narco state compared to ISIS. Last, I look at some Western misconceptions about Islam. All that is coming up right now. Arsenal for Democracy is usually recorded in studio every Sunday and is available for download on Wednesdays at arsenalfordemocracy.com and from iTunes. We air the show in Delaware on 91.3 FM and stream it from WVUD.org on Wednesdays at 6 p.m. Eastern. Follow us on Twitter at AFD Radio or like us on Facebook. This is the Arsenal for Democracy. You're listening to Arsenal for Democracy. I'm your host, Bill Humphrey. Joining me in studio again is Nate. Nate, welcome back.
Thanks, Bill.
So we're going to talk first about Nigeria. A couple weeks ago, I replayed the episode a segment from the episode where I had interviewed Pilar Kazer, a historian who has done a lot of work in West Africa. And in that interview, she explained a lot of the background of the conflict that's been going on in Nigeria since 2009 and the Boko Haram insurgency there. There's a lot of, I think, misinformation and stuff that goes around in Western media with regard to what that is and why that movement, you know, arose in the first place. But I want to talk specifically about the weird way that the Western media covers news presented by Nigerian news sources and specifically the Nigerian government and military there. I think that this is something that I've been keeping an eye on and kind of getting more and more frustrated with in recent months, you know, ever since the girls were kidnapped back in May, the Chibok girls were, you know, 200 or so were kidnapped by Boko Haram. And there's been a lot of misinformation that's gone around about that. But for some reason, compared to other countries, you know, developing nations or countries with sort of, you know, somewhat suspicious governments and things like that, the Western media, U.S. media, and British media tends to not really do a lot of fact-checking, as far as I can tell, on the reports that come out of Nigeria, which just seems like kind of a problem. And it's gotten to the point where, like, the gap between what is communicated and what is true is so wide that it's amazing that these media outlets haven't gotten wise to it yet. Because I can literally just look and compare like two different articles and see the obvious contradiction and it's not pointed out. So this kind of really came to a head for me on October 17th when I had the radio on in the car and they said, oh, you know, the Nigerian defense minister says that they've achieved a peace deal with Boko Haram and they're going to get all the girls back. And I was like, okay, well, sure, because that doesn't fit with like anything that's been happening in the past several weeks or, you know, the previous month. And this line really caught my attention. They said that there had been no confirmation of this or comment by Boko Haram. Now, if you stop and think about that, if you're announcing a big peace deal or a ceasefire or something, presumably you should be able to get the other side to comment on it if it's true. And apparently, nobody could. And that right there should have been the biggest red flag in the world that should have stopped all these media outlets from reporting this. They should have gone, wait, let's go check this and see if this actually makes sense. Why go to, you know, go to press or go to air with a segment like that when you haven't actually been able to verify it?
Well, maybe they just got some sort of email from a Nigerian official and they just took it as fact and maybe wired some money over or something and then just basically did not want to really raise any questions and just maybe led the news broadcast with that. Yeah, I mean, these definitely seem like some questionable reports. You know, I think you wrote on Arsenal for Democracy that there were multiple times where they actually reported that they had rescued the kidnapped girls and they had to retract them. And, you know, it's sort of just like they're playing a little fast and loose with the truth and just in hopes that maybe they're, you know, seen as doing something in response to this crisis rather than just, I mean, letting Boko Haram sort of do whatever they want. And because they, I mean, I'm guessing the reason that they're not going all in with, you know, a bunch of forces to recapture these kidnapped girls is that it's just not particularly feasible. The government doesn't have, maybe the forces to engage in some sort of battle or conflict, or they don't have the political will just to do everything for these, like a military operation for
the kidnapped girls. Or they might be too incompetent.
Well, I mean, that's definitely a possibility as well. It doesn't seem like they're getting all that far in negotiations.
Yeah.
I mean, you want to comment on that?
Yeah, well, so I was reading these reports and commentaries by Ahmad Salkita, who's a northern Nigerian journalist who now lives outside Nigeria because he's being harassed so much by the government there for basically pointing out all the times that they make stuff up. And he's, he's very opposed to Boko Haram. I think it said that in the thing I was reading that his parents had actually been driven out, of their local community by Boko Haram. But he also is like, the government is ridiculous in this situation. And I mean, there were a whole bunch of problems with the report, but some of it was just like, again, it was the basic level of journalism that wasn't being done. He said, why would the government be announcing that they had obtained a ceasefire when they're not the ones who declared, war in the first place? Like, if you're going to have a ceasefire announcement, it has to come from the people that are rebelling. Otherwise, there's clearly nothing there. There's nothing to the story. And, other things that sort of developed over the next couple days after that initial huge announcement had been made was that by the next day, so that was an announcement on Friday, by Saturday, you had those reports being revised to government officials saying that the Boko Haram leadership is on board with the truce, that violence was being perpetrated by groups of fighters who hadn't gotten word of the agreement. That was a report by Voice of America News. And then saying that that they're continuing to negotiate with Boko Haram, that these talks are ongoing, that there had been an agreement in principle. So they went literally in less than 24 hours, went from saying we have a peace deal to saying we have a deal in principle, which means that even if you believe that all they had gotten an agreement for was an agreement to discuss how to get to some objective that everyone agreed on, right? And that's not the same thing at all.
Yeah, and it seems like there have been some questionable reports coming out about just what these various African countries are doing to combat Boko Haram. Like, as you mentioned in the blog post, haven't the governments of Cameroon and Nigeria claimed that they've killed the head of Boko Haram several times?
Yeah, like this year alone, they've said that they've killed him. They've both claimed to have killed the head of Boko Haram multiple times. And they've been claiming this many, many times since 2009. There's various news articles that I found. I think one of them was maybe in New York Magazine or something like that, where they basically said, like, this guy has supposedly been killed like 5 or 6 times and just keeps coming back. And eventually it's gotten to the point where the Nigerian government just claims, oh, that was actually a lookalike that we killed or whatever. And it's like, he's been dead the whole time. It's like, come on, no, he hasn't been dead the whole time. And now, they literally, the most recent time they said that was a month before they said that they were negotiating with a representative acting on behalf of that guy. So either they killed him, or they're negotiating with his representative. But one of those things can't be true if the other one is, and more likely neither of them is true. Another thing that Salkita reported or criticized about these reports of a ceasefire was he said he had no idea who the guy was that was supposedly acting on behalf of Boko Haram. He also pointed out that not only had he never heard of this guy, despite having reported heavily on Boko Haram and having a lot of contacts inside Boko Haram at the highest levels, he said this guy has like a Christian first name. I think it means, born on a Sunday or something like that, which obviously isn't of significance to Muslims. And considering all these, insurgents go by basically nom de guerre, war names, even if he had somehow been given that name by his parents, he wouldn't be referring to himself that way. So, at best case scenario, Nigeria got hoodwinked into negotiating with someone who had no power to do these negotiations. Worst case scenario, there's no negotiations at all, and they completely made this up.
Yeah, and we're getting also a bunch of more reports that some of this conflict is perhaps spilling into some other countries in the region. There was a report out of Cameroon that they killed 39 Boko Haram fighters. Some of them had crossed over, I think, the border,
yeah.
And they were intercepted. Obviously, as we've been talking, sometimes it's tough to know exactly the veracity of these reports, especially when they're coming, you know, from the random small African newspapers. Like, I'm just looking at VanguardGR.com, like, or Vanguard NGR, which I guess is a Nigerian newspaper.
I think
looks
so,
like.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I'm not saying that it's necessarily wrong. I'm just saying, you know, it's tough to confirm some of these reports. But, I mean, it does now look like, you know, maybe that this is no longer just a Nigerian problem, and there's having an impact on some other
there
countries.
There have been very high-profile kidnappings across the border in Cameroon. The deputy prime minister's wife was actually kidnapped and has actually been returned, unlike the Chibok girls in Nigeria. They had kidnapped her, a bunch of other Cameroonians, and a bunch of Chinese laborers, and they were returned in a deal with, you know, probably involving payments or something, but we don't know the details of that. And, you know, Chad has declared war on them. And then Chad is supposedly mediating this, but I don't know how you would let them be the mediators if they're also at war with Boko Haram. So it's just a whole mess.
Also, randomly, the French are in there as well. Like, there's a, I'm reading a quote here from a French general who is saying that the military group strength has peaked and that they may be slightly declining a little bit despite some of the recent kidnappings and raids. Apparently France, because obviously they sent their troops in Mali in 2012, I think.
This was early 2013.
And they have a, like, small strip, I guess, that they're patrolling in the Sahel. And they've got about 3,000 guys, mostly surveillance work and
peacekeepers. This is that rapid reaction force that we were talking about on last week's episode that France has deployed to Mali, Burkina Faso, Chad, and Niger. I think those were the countries involved there. And, you know, it's just, this is widespread conflict, but you can't believe anything that's coming out of this.
Yeah,
I mean, they're putting so much pressure on the Nigerian media to report the official claims of the government. They never provide any proof for any of these claims. And, you know, that French general claims that the force is declining, but, I mean, they also said that about the force in Mali, and they're sort of bounced back partially in attacking UN troops. And in this situation, you know, the attacks started, you know, accelerating a day after this purported ceasefire was announced, and they've continued to ramp up since then, pretty much showing that there was no ceasefire to begin with, and, you know, that was just completely not true. And you have the... you know, like a month before this happened, they also claimed that they had broken up, you know, they had killed the leader of Boko Haram and broken up the group, and they were, you know, running away and whatever. And again, within a day, there were huge attacks happening on the Nigerian-Cameroon border. I mean, every time that they say this, the group just proves that they're lying, and they're making these claims with no proof whatsoever. I mean, this is, you know, like, we're just, this is tip of the iceberg here. In general, there's a lot of credibility problems. They had another situation where they claimed that where it was uncovered that government agents had tried to take $9.3 million in cash to South Africa to buy weapons using some private plane that a pastor owned or something, which raises all kinds of questions. Anyway, they failed to declare the cash, and it was all seized by the South African customs officials. And then the members of parliament tried to have an inquiry, and the government and the military said, nope, we refuse to talk about it on national security grounds. And then, you know, a few days later, they tried to say that the girls had been rescued. Then they had to retract that claim. And this was all happening a month before this situation. And it basically seemed like this giant cover-up, essentially, that they were trying to... anytime something bad happens, they immediately try to divert attention, not by something little, but by going for the biggest lie possible. But it's not even one of those lies that's so big that everyone believes it, because it's immediately proven false.
I mean, honestly, that doesn't really sound all that different from the U.S. government sometimes. So, I mean, it's like, it's easy to criticize them because of just, like, seeming sheer incompetence and, like, craziness of the situation over there. But I can think of a lot of instances where, especially the Bush administration, did a lot of pretty similar things. Just, you know.
Or wag the dog scenarios.
Yeah, and you can go back to Clinton and all that. I mean, it just, it seems like that's kind of a time-honored political tactic, just... distract, lie, cover up, you know, just get everyone to look at something other than basically what's going on right in front of them. So everyone does it, even the Nigerians.
Well, I think you raise a good point there, but the issue is, so this is, you know, it's the most populous country in Africa. It's the biggest economy in Africa. It's a conflict that remains very much in the news. But the problem is, you know, other countries do this, like you said. But the U.S. media, at least with other countries, maybe not with the U.S., but the U.S. media tends to at least do minimal fact checking on some of these claims. Like, they don't, it's not
sometimes.
Like, right, but it's not like hopefully. Every time they just report it as, you know, according to the Nigerian defense yeah. minister or according well, to senior military officials, right. and then they just don't
call it out. The thing is now, with the issues that journalism has been facing in the past decade with, you know, decline of advertising sales and, you know, various papers collapsing, is that many of them are severely cutting back on their foreign correspondence. They don't actually have a correspondent on the ground covering international conflicts or serious international situations. So maybe they'll send someone to cover situation in Israel or, you know, Syria or that area, but some, like, you know, relatively low-level conflict in Africa, just basically, you know, someone at the newswire desk is just writing up based on reports of things that are going on and government statements, and you sort of have to take those on fact because you don't have the sources on the ground, you don't have the local contacts, you don't have just people that know what's going on and you can talk to and get unbiased reports from them.
Yeah.
You basically just have to go on what's, you know, what's being said by the government.
And I suppose,
and that's unfortunate.
Right. I suppose also the other big factor is the rising kidnapping of journalists, specific
yeah.
targeting of journalists in places like Syria or northern Nigeria. You know, whether it's local journalists or international journalists, that's probably a big deterrent to sending in people or even contracting local people, because you don't want to put them in harm's way. And so you have to rely on those official sources. But, and you know, so I think that you're raising excellent points all around. And I don't entirely fault the media. I just fault how it's presented
yeah.
so uncritically, because official source reliance is a problem or a common feature, however you want to look at it. But it's a thing that's been around for a while and is manageable to a certain extent as long as there's a history of reliability with those sources. Like, if the U.S. government or the U.K. government or the French government says something relatively banal or whatever, you can report that, and that's usually going to be correct. I mean, it might not be, but it's a lot more likely
yeah.
to be correct than in some governments. But the issue here is that they don't, even after they've been essentially duped time after time this year alone, they don't seem to be pointing that out or even qualifying it. And, you know, there's that report that I heard should have said something like, the Nigerian government today claimed that, not, you know, announced that, you know, that they claimed that such and such had happened, but this could not be verified independently. Like, you know, that happens in a lot of cases. Like with the Syria coverage, I noticed that they say, you know, local sources on the ground say X, Y, and Z, but this could not be independently verified. And it's not great, but at least you've presented the information to your readers or your audience in a way that's a little bit more qualified. Because I think that right now, the situation, it's like, you know, the comparison that I made, which maybe this seems a little extreme, but the level of, like, gargantuan lies that are made on a regular basis by the highest levels of government in Nigeria and the military now are such that they are on par with things that you hear from North Korea, which typically aren't reported with that level of just sort of trusting in it. They, you know, we don't go, oh, you know, the leader of North Korea, you know, hit a hole in one on every hole on the golf course because he's the greatest golfer of all time. And then there's no, like, you know, if they say that,
yeah.
it's mocking, right?
Well, yeah,
like,
I mean, it's super easy to knock the North Koreans because, I mean, especially with Kim Jong-il, you had a very, like, you know, easy target in the sense that, you know, loves Crevassier, is a big fan of, like, Western movies, you know, films his own movies, like, you know, is like, I don't know, a sex addict or whatever was going on there. So, I mean, they're just, like, it's just ridiculously simple to make fun of him and not take him seriously. Whereas I feel like most people don't quite understand the various just levels, not only how the government is run and how much corruption there is and how trustworthy the people is. They just don't know one African country from another, I feel like, is the problem a lot of the time. Like, okay, Zambia versus, like, Namibia, like, what's the difference? And, like, which government is corrupt, which one is not? And, you know, especially as I talked about people that are not on the ground there, they're probably just coming in from, like, you know, continental-type view where, like, you just don't have a good understanding of the differences between, you know, various African countries and the divisions within those African countries that produce political realities there, whether it's like differing tribes or ethnic groups or language barriers, things like that. So it's just, I feel like just most people don't have a relatively good understanding of, you know, the interior politics of various regimes and therefore just sort of like default to taking them at their word. like, I guess a lot of people, especially if you're not familiar with the situation, maybe aren't inclined to be as skeptical or as, you know, inquisitive, especially if it's just sort of like a Reuters write-up, like not like an investigation into like the corruption of the Nigerian government, because I mean, I assume there's a lot of it.
Yes.
But those
WikiLeaks Cablegate dumps revealed a lot of that.
Yeah, but rather there's some report on like some conflict over, and then you're sort of like writing it up like, okay, whatever, they said that, they've done this, this, and that. And, you know, unless you have a Lagos bureau, which I guess most papers don't at this point, you know, despite it being one of a giant, massive city, if you don't have that bureau, you're probably just not going to be able to, you know, get the actual information and report it accurately.
All right. So before we close out this segment, I basically came up with three recommendations for how the media should report on claims by Nigeria's military. It's pretty straightforward. One, if Boko Haram doesn't confirm a deal and those kidnapped girls aren't actually physically confirmed to be returned, there's no deal and the girls haven't been rescued or freed or anything. Two, the Nigerian military and the government lie spectacularly, constantly, regularly, and at this point, anything that they assert should be assumed false until it's proven true. At this point, there's no room for giving them the benefit of the doubt. Three, stop repeating anything that they say and everything that they say without absolute confirmation. You know, official sources are, as I said, only worth something if they're usually reliably factual. And I think that this isn't just about me being like offended that they're doing bad reporting or whatever. I think it has an actual consequence, which is that, as Nate mentioned earlier, this basically allows the Nigerian government to make it look like they're making progress without actually having to make progress. Because when the progress fails to materialize, they very easily just say, well, we tried, we put this offer on the table or whatever, and they spat in our faces and stabbed us in the back and, you know, restarted the conflict or whatever. And, you know, like Nate said, this is not something that's exclusive to Nigeria. A lot of governments and countries do this, especially when they're doing counterinsurgency stuff. They announce, well, we've got a, you know, a temporary deal, or we've got negotiations for peace that are going to happen, and then it doesn't happen, and then usually it wasn't serious to begin with, and then it allows them to say, look at these, you know, backstabbing terrorists, you know, we can't possibly work with them, but we gave it our best shot. So I think there is damage to reporting some of this stuff uncritically, and that's why I think this is so important. And of course, like Nate said, I mean, it's a huge, very populous country and everything. It's vitally important within Africa and within the world in general. It's going to be one of the most populated countries in the world in not very far from now. So this is something that we need to get better reporting on, and unfortunately there are a lot of barriers to having that accuracy in reporting. All right, well, we are going to be right back with another conflict analysis, but one that is much closer to home, right after this break from arsenalfordemocracy.com and WVUD. Welcome back to Arsenal for Democracy. I'm your host, Bill Humphrey. Still in studio with me is Nate. There are heavily armed militant groups with substantial military experience terrorizing, extorting, and beheading people in a major oil-producing desert country to the south of a NATO member, and they've had a destabilizing effect across borders in a wide region encompassing many countries. They lack popular support and rule their territory primarily by fear. And they are the Mexican cartels. I think you can see the parallel that I'm going for there. But basically, as I argued in a post on October 20th, based off of a very extensive report by Musa Al-Gharbi in Al Jazeera America, the situation with the Mexican cartels has a lot of parallels to the situation with ISIS in Syria and Iraq. And interestingly, no American airstrikes against the Mexican cartels in Mexico, which, to be clear, is not what I'm saying we should do, but as I pointed out and as Garby pointed out, if you actually look at the statistics and a lot of the examples, the cases do line up pretty similarly, and there's not a whole lot of arguments that you can make for why we should be going after ISIS that we couldn't also apply if we wanted to the cartels in Mexico. Essentially, at the end of the day, the only real difference, as we'll get to, is that ISIS is Islamic extremism, and the cartels have a different form of extremism, which also includes their own weird cult religion that's not based on, like, mainstream religion. That's a little bit of a side tangent. But, you know, that's the thing, is that a lot of this sort of, like, ISIS is the most terrible in the world, we must defeat ISIS, we have to do all these things. I'm not saying it's bad to go after ISIS, but the fact that we go after them and not a lot of other situations really does bring up that question of, are we only doing it because we have this pathological fear in the United States of Muslims and Muslim extremists that seems to override every other, like, cost-benefit analysis possible at this point? You know, we've talked, Nate and I have talked about this before, Greg's also talked about it when he's been on the show, but basically, if you look at the statistics, Muslims remain one of the, if not generally, the most disliked group, religious group of mainstream groups in the United States. And there's just a lot of fear and suspicion and misunderstanding, and that seems to be motivating a lot of policy, or at least a lot of the cheerleading for policy, particularly coming from the Republican side. But, you know, by the numbers, by the examples, by the territorial control, by the geopolitical strategic factors, in my opinion, the war in Mexico is still a bigger threat to the United States than the war in Syria. Nate, your thoughts?
Yeah, well, I mean, if you just look at a lot of recent examples of terrorist attacks on American mosques, you'll see that it's pretty clear that there's still a, you know, widespread anti-Muslim sentiment in the U.S. that's, you know, often either bubbling under the surface or really above the surface and really above board for, you know, the mindset of many Republican politicians and just conservative figures in general. Just the way they talk about Muslims seems like literally all billion-plus Muslims are, you know, holding scimitars between their teeth and have, like, explosives strapped to their chest and are about ready to blow, so.
But I want to make clear here, though, that of all of these, you know, irrational hatreds, this is the one that also crosses the most strongly over party lines and into the Democratic side.
And that's entirely true, and it's... it's not just Republicans, so maybe I amend that a little bit. It has been really sickening, though, over the past couple of years. You know, you've got, like, mosques being built in Tennessee just because, yes, there are Muslims that live in Tennessee or Arkansas or, you know, any place in the U.S. just because it's a pretty widespread population now. And, you know, someone's trying to build a mosque and their tractor gets blown up. Like, there are legit bombs being placed on some of these mosque construction sites, or arson attempts, or violence, fear, and intimidation against members of their own community. People are basically decided that take it into their own hands and decide that they want to actually be the terrorists and not give the Muslims, I guess, a chance to be terrorists or something. Like, they don't even know these people, and yet they've decided that, you know, it's not at all acceptable to even have a place of worship in their area. And we saw that guy who went up in the Sikh temple and started shooting it up because I guess he thought they were Muslims. So that was a pretty tragic incident as well. When it comes to cartels, not to get too off track and just talking about anti-Muslim sentiment, but I mean, I would say that there's a little bit difference in the sense of between ISIS and these cartels, and just because, you know, you can say what you want about ISIS, and maybe it's not necessarily having, like, some purely jihadist political motive. They have also other concerns with actually acquiring power on the ground. It's not all just about their philosophical and religious implications of their, you know, of what they believe. That's not the only thing that they're doing. The cartels are out to make money. They're out to control territory and move their products and gain a foothold in the United States. So I don't know if it's all that similar, just because they're doing things for very different reasons, money versus, you know, political and territorial power and popular following. So that doesn't change the fact that they're extremely dangerous and they've been killing and beheading people here in the United States. And I think you mentioned, Bill, the amount of people killed is surpassing a level that, you know, of the 9/11 terrorist attacks. There's been a lot of deaths. Now,
yeah, Americans attacked in the United States, there have been more killed by the cartels than by Al-Qaeda on 9/11.
Some of these people may have been involved in the drug trade themselves, and, you know, often what happens when you're involved in the drug trade is you have a much higher chance of being murdered or victim of violent crime or, you know, perpetrator of violent crime. So, you know, there's all that to deal with as well. But, you know, when you're finding headless bodies, you know, in the desert here in the United States, that's something that's highly concerning.
I don't know what we would do about the situation. You can't do airstrikes in Mexico. You can't invade Mexico. That's not going to solve it. Sending arms clearly hasn't solved it. Technical advisors, that didn't solve it either. We've seen this play out in Colombia before as well. And, you know, you hear the argument, well, just legalize drugs or legalize marijuana specifically or do this and that and end the war on drugs. And I mean, that's a part of the picture. But at this point, these cartels are so well established and have diversified their activities to so far beyond just drugs. You know, you've got one of the cartels controls 90% of the avocado production in the entire country of Mexico. And a lot of that goes to the United States. You're not going to ban avocados, probably. So, you know, at this point, they've achieved a level of control where even just solving the drug war isn't going to solve the situation. So I don't know what we do. And I don't think, you know, Nate, you don't have anything either here. You know, we're just kind of working in the dark on this. But it's that question of, well, this is a serious problem, and it's going to take a lot of complicated solutions to fix it. But that's probably true for ISIS, too. And the arguments made for why we're doing what we're doing with regard to ISIS could be made back toward Mexico. And yet we don't do that. So we need to come up with a better plan for both countries and both situations and what to do about those. To give some statistics from the report by Al Gharbi in Al Jazeera America, so the UN statistics for the situation in Iraq said that 9,000 civilians have been killed, 17,000 wounded in 2014, and this was more than half of those came since they seized large parts of northern Iraq in June. And they're likely responsible for several thousand more deaths in Syria, but the numbers are a little bit harder to get there. To give the comparison, the cartels in 2013 alone murdered more than 16,000 people in the country of Mexico. That's leaving out all the Central American deaths and the U.S. deaths. And from 2006 to 2012, they murdered 60,000 people. They're basically killing people over the last 7 years at a rate of one every half hour. And those are the estimates from the Mexican government itself, which has a tendency to try to cover up and suppress the numbers, which means they're probably actually higher than that.
Almost certainly more.
And possibly even 50% higher, according to some estimates. You know, and then you get to that argument about, well, ISIS is so barbarous. And as Nate said, you get the beheadings and everything.
It's tough to get more barbarous than some of these cartels.
I mean, right.
When you're dissolving people in vats of acid... That's pretty bad. Stuff to get a lot worse than that.
So he says that there have been hundreds of beheadings every year. They dismember and mutilate corpses and display, you know, piles of body in town squares and things like that. They, you know, target women and children. They also use social media just like ISIS does. I mean, a lot of the tactics you could, you know, even suggest, wonder if ISIS got some of them from the cartels, because the cartels are operating, you know, sort of at the cutting edge of this kind of behavior. They recruit child soldiers as young as 11. Are kidnapping people to be drug mules or prostitutes. They're killing children to harvest their organs, all kinds of crazy things. And the most sort of recent thing that put this back in the news was the 43 students who were protesting against the cartel control and the government corruption at a teaching college. And 43 students just disappeared. And then mass graves of charred bodies were found. And they don't even think the cartels murdered them. They're pretty sure the police did. Because that's the thing is, you know, ISIS tries to take over and hold territory directly and replace the government and replace the local, like, you know, oil production officials, things like that, unless they can get their cooperation. The cartels are the ultimate force multipliers. They basically just come in, get everyone to stop, you know, responding to them so that they can operate with essentially impunity from the local population. And then they co-opt the existing government structure, the existing police force, the existing, you know, mayor or whoever, and basically say, this is our town now. We don't have to declare an official state because your government now works for us. And people either go along with it because they're scared, or they get, you know, financial incentives to go along with it. But, I mean, one of the, you know, cartels, Los Zetas, is basically all former Mexican special forces and U.S. special forces. Some of them defected in a mass mutiny from the Mexican, you know, army several years back, I think 2005 or so, or early 2000s. And, you know, they rapidly spread with, you know, initially just starting out with, I think, like 250 guys or something spread out to take over most of the Gulf of Mexico coast in Mexico, the eastern coast. That was mainly because they're just taking over these existing government territories and whatever, and then saying, well, we control this now. And, you know, for a while from 2005 or especially 2006 to, you know, probably 2012, under the President Calderon, who's now out of office, there was that huge ramp up in direct deployment of combat troops against the cartels. And the inevitable effect was that both sides just ramped up. You know, once you militarize that conflict, the other side militarizes it back. And they had the capacity to do that. A lot of them were former military. They did that. It then became a war zone. And the only solution to dial this back was that the new president basically is just pretending that the problem went away. And it's just saying, well, let's focus on the economy. I'm fine in Mexico City because this is the like one area where the cartels haven't completely taken power. So,
yeah, there was actually a really interesting Vice documentary series about a group of Mormons who are living in a part of Mexico that's heavily controlled by the cartel. And just in case people are wondering, like, there was a bunch of Mormon colonies that were found in Mexico after people decided that they wanted to continue the polygamy system outside of the United States. So just, they're still there randomly. Like, that's where Mitt Romney's parents were born. So there's like a strong Mexico Mormon connection. Anyway, some of, like, at this point, many of them have been attacked and some of them have been killed by cartels, basically sending a message that, you know, they controlled the territory and, you know, they didn't want Mormons interfering with, you know, anything that was going on. And so in response, the Mormons have begun to arm themselves. And it's just like creating, as you said, sort of like this arms race to, you know, sort of defend themselves against the cartels. There was also an interesting scene where they go into the town square and just like at a baseball game. And like, it's very clear that like they're being watched, they're being followed. And eventually they get like, I think a threat or something and they just have to leave. Like they can't stay there filming anymore because, you know, like the ridiculously hipster Vice reporter is probably going to get decapitated and like burned in a vat of acid or something if we stay there too much longer. So, I mean, you see that it's an extremely, extremely dangerous situation just for the ordinary people that live there. And especially if you're like kind of an outsider like the Mormons are. I mean, they might just come and like kidnap you or kill you or just do something like that just to prove they can.
And so that, you know, there was like a Global Post article that I found where they had pictures of these DIY tanks that the Mormon vigilante groups had made where they were just basically welding armor onto big trucks and stuff like that and reinforcing the tires and everything. And then they could use them for ramming and stuff like that. Which obviously that's not really the solution either, because as I said, every time one side ramps up the sort of militarization of it, the other side does the same thing and then goes one step further. So it's this sort of endless cycle. You know, and another big activist was recently murdered by the cartels. She was, I think maybe a lawyer or something like that. And then she had sort of been speaking out anonymously on social media. And they basically tracked down her location, like the cartels did, figured out her IP and everything, tracked her down, and then like recorded and photographed them murdering her brutally, and then posted it to her social media account and said, like, you know, this is the end of my life or something like that. And it was just horrible. And this kind of thing is not an outlier. This has been going on for years now, like 5 years. No, not even, that's longer than 5 years. And it's just, I mean, at this point, it's bananas. And it's just going on. And they're continue, and, you know, they've not only have they co-opted the government, but they've managed to silence a lot of the reporting coming out of that. They also target journalists just like ISIS does, except on a way, way higher rate. You know, there have been 57 journalists at least killed by the cartels or by the government, whether they were reporting on cartel crimes or exposing government complicity. This is, again, according to that Al Jazeera report. And a lot of them have been brutally murdered and so forth. And then, you know, we hear about ISIS is going to enslave women and send them to the sex trade and everything, which that's true. That's a very valid and serious concern that's also not getting enough attention. But, you know, right next to our southern border, tens of thousands of Mexican women have been taken, you know, as slaves, either for work or for, you know, sex trafficking, or they have just simply been raped as an intimidation tool. And, you know, so, like, you know, they talk about this, you know, this beheading, these two beheadings that happened initially in August or whatever, and that was what motivated, you know, Americans to get all upset and angry that we've got to go and attack ISIS in Syria and we can't allow them to build this state. And it's like, well, we literally allowed a, you know, directly anti-American, like, narco state to be set up next door to us. We didn't really do a whole lot except, oh, let's send more weapons or whatever, which, again, doesn't really seem to solve the situation. I don't think airstrikes would solve the situation either. But, you know, ISIS didn't even attack any American positions, government facilities or anything before U.S. intervention started in Iraq. Yet the Mexican cartels have actually attacked U.S. consulates in Mexico. And we don't hear that much about this. So that's that question. It's like, they haven't, ISIS hasn't staged attacks in the United States. They didn't target the United States. And I'm not saying that we shouldn't have gone after them necessarily, but why is it that you get one situation where the treatment is one way and the other situation, you know, where it's just essentially completely ignored, you know, and there's 5,700 Americans that were killed from 2006 to 2010, a 4-year period by, you know, in the U.S. by cartel related violence. And then there's various Americans who were killed, you know, in Mexico, often when they were visiting, you know, tourists and things like that. And they've got these sort of religious cults and everything. And, you know, it's one of the largest oil producers in the world. It's usually in the top 10, both in production and exports, although, you know, it's starting to decline a little bit. What is the distinction? Ultimately, you boil it down and it basically just comes down to this instinctive opposition to Islam, because like I said at the top of the segment, you know, if you look at that Pew poll from a couple of years ago, Muslims are the most disliked major religious group in the United States. If you look, they ask people to rate them on a feeling thermometer from 0 to 100, and you know, the your evangelicals and your Catholics and everything are quite high up on the list. Jewish people are actually the highest, interestingly enough. And then you have, you know, atheists and Muslims down in the 40% range, and atheists get a 41 on average, while Muslims get a 40. So Muslims are actually more unpopular in the United States than atheists are. And, you know, that just, it manifests directly into various attacks. And like I said, you know, Democrats are putting Muslims on a 47. Republicans, yeah, it's much lower. It's a 33, but 47 is still pretty bad compared to a lot of, you know, groups that Democrats rate. And like Nate said, there have been all these attacks. I looked into this a couple months ago. There have been at least 24 attacks on Sikh Americans, not even Muslim Americans, but Sikh Americans, just because people think that they're Muslim, yeah, since 9/11.
Well, there was a spike, I think, after 9/11 against Sikhs, just because, like, them wearing turbans, I think, is very identifying. And, you know, your average racist person who's likely to commit violence against a minority is not going to probably not know the difference between, you know, a Sikh and a Muslim. So,
and because of the various, you know, Palestinian hijackings and the World Trade Center bombing in 1993, even before 9/11, anti-Muslim violence was starting to rise. The Oklahoma City bombing, which was in 1995 done by a white Christian extremist guy, that attack was immediately followed by attacks on Muslims because people assumed that Muslims must be responsible for bombing this federal building instead of an extremist, you know, white man,
and
Christian and it, white man.
Yeah, and now the this sort of anti-Muslim sentiment seems to have come back up in the past couple of years. I don't know if it was maybe connected to that, like the underwear bomber, that guy who was trying to blow up a plane, and, you know, it just seems like there's been a resurgence recently.
Yeah, I mean, and you're right, because this even has come up just in the last week or so. Marco Rubio, the senator from Florida, Republican senator, getting another question about, you know, why won't Obama take the Muslim threat seriously? Is it because he's secretly a Muslim? And it's just like, okay, so we're now... we're now 5 years into this, 5.5 years into the Obama administration, and a Republican sitting senator still doesn't have the guts to say anything other than, I don't know about all that. And then pivots to saying, yes, I think we do need to, you know, take XYZ threats more seriously, or we need to look into homegrown terrorism. That was, I think, what the question was about homegrown Muslim terrorism. And Marco Rubio goes on and on about homegrown terrorism in the United States, because this is after the Canadian attacks, the one in Quebec and in Ottawa. And then he starts saying things like, you know, this is a new threat that in the 21st century, and we've never had to face a threat like this, and something, something, social media, blah, 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 the internet. And you're like, Are you serious? Look at all those white Christian extremist attacks in the 1990s and before then. What about the entire history of the KKK?
What about all those anarchists, man? Like,
this is such a long-standing threat.
Anything like this.
Homegrown terrorism doesn't come from Muslims in this country. Like, the number of attacks, the ratio is so small between extremist Muslim attacks and every other extremist group that's, like, white and Christian.
Other than the Tsarnaevs, like, there was the doctor at Fort Hood, but I'm struggling to come up with anything else, really. I mean, it just, that hasn't been the issue. There have been terrorist issues involving Muslims, but it's usually not random Joe Muslim from Detroit is deciding that he's going to go shoot up a school or blow people up because he hates America despite living in it and enjoying all of its freedoms.
And they talk about, you know, oh, these extremists trying to go to Syria or trying to go to Somalia or whatever. And in, like, all of those cases, it's basically almost without fail, they're either going over there to fight and explicitly not fighting here, or they're from the, you know, ethnic group or the national group or whatever that's involved, and they're going because they see it as this patriotic struggle for their homeland.
I did hear a story about a couple of girls, like teenage girls, that ended up getting as far as, like, Frankfurt, Germany. They're trying to go to Syria to, like, join ISIS and, like, fight in the conflict or something.
Yeah, ISIS has a very aggressive program to recruit women online, and they've actually, I mean, it's weird because you would think that they wouldn't be interested, but apparently it's working pretty well.
So, it's not like there's never been a recruit or, like, that these social media videos and stuff that ISIS puts out don't work.
But they're going over there. They're not staying here.
Right. It hasn't, you know, incited a wave of, like, faceless terrorist violence perpetrated by, like, all these secret Muslims or whatever, so... I mean, also another thing we're talking about, the resurgence of this, I think part of it is Obama. I mean, I think part of it is George Bush, for all of his faults, what you want to say about him, he did emphasize a number of times that his beef was not ever with, you know, the Muslim religion. I mean, there may have been things that his administration or Republican parties did that was sort of like dog whistling about, like, the Muslim menace, but at least he made an effort, at least publicly, to say, you know, Muslims are our friends, and, like, this is about, like, a certain group of Muslims that we're attacking. We have to work with, you know, the good Muslims, I guess. I don't think he was ever particularly eloquent on that issue, but maybe, you know, the fact that we've gone from that, where the Republican president is, you know, saying those things nominally, to a situation where you have this, you know, potentially secret, ancient, dark Muslim who is now running the presidency, and then everyone sort of gets their anti-Obama sentiments that are unrelated to him being quote-unquote possibly Muslim, and then everything just sort of gets tangled up together. So
right, you know, I think that he's less willing to take on this problem head-on because he doesn't want to be seen as validating this conspiracy theory.
I mean, sometimes you got to wonder about that. Sometimes you have to wonder whether the intense amount of backlash on certain things that Obama has gotten has impacted his ability to sort of be a... you know, use the bully pulpit or use his public image to really aggressively go after certain things, because, you know, then you have all the conspiracy theories start up all again, you know, just intense opposition to whatever he does or whatever he is. So it's just unfortunate.
All right. Well, Nate, thank you so much for joining me. We're going to be back in just a second, but it's just going to be me. Thanks for being in studio again with me this week.
Thanks, Bill.
All right, Arsenal for Democracy will return in just a moment from WVUD and arsenalfordemocracy.com. You're still listening to Arsenal for Democracy. I'm your host, Bill Humphrey. Continuing the theme that we had just been discussing earlier this hour about Islamophobia and, as I mentioned, misunderstandings about the situation, both in general with Islam as well as with specific conflicts like Nigeria, I thought that I would present an op-ed that was recently published on October 4th, 2014 in The Globalist, where I used to work as the assistant editor, and it's on the topic of reform Islam versus the billionaire barons. Islam is naturally decentralized. Rarely, if ever, in its history, and certainly not recently, has there been a pope-like figure setting the official interpretations of holy text or overall direction of the faith. There are multiple overarching schools of interpretation within Sunni Islam alone, dating to the 8th century. Adherence to competing doctrines, even legal decisions on Sharia law, is essentially voluntary, unless backed by a state. Want a reformed Islam? Join a reform-minded mosque following a reform-minded leader. Want a fire-breathing, antiquated, violent Islam? You can find that too. This internal fragmentation, present since the beginning, makes it hard to paint accurately with a broad brush, or even correctly assess trends across the rather nebulous area that the West has dubbed, quote, the Muslim world. Often, the Western analysis seems to read a uniformity that isn't there. From a religious standpoint, the internal debate right now is probably even more complicated and tenuous than the 30 Years' War in Germany. At least in the latter, all the German princes could pretty much pick between two options, following the Pope or following the general precepts of Martin Luther's Protestantism. Sunni Islam alone has a handful of diverging schools of thought, further splintered by the separate followings of various popular current scholars. Unfortunately, the loudest and perhaps best organized subsegment of the sect recently seems to be the engine driving extremist groups all over the world. But even that analysis misdiagnoses and misattributes a centralization that is not really there beyond a superficial level. The emerging global networks of fundamentalist Sunni Islamic terrorism of the past 5, 15, and 25 years are linked in practice only because they have voluntarily associated with each other and with a specific brand of the religion. The networks have co-opted or completely supplanted decades-old movements in places as diverse as Mali or the Philippines, which had aimed to address local poverty and institutional inequalities, or obtain independence. This voluntary association between groups, in countries from West Africa to Southeast Asia, has only been made possible by atypically centralized funding sources that provide seed money and setup advice for local franchises before they are able to become financially self-sustaining. Most of the franchises have not been able to reach self-sufficiency and continue only by the grace of the startup funders. The rest generally continue to receive advice from the funding sources and remain associated with the groups for brand value and the attention that comes with it. These funders, not preachers, are the ones who really shape existing local grievances and separatist movements into a globalized, semi-unified ideology. Without them, the decentralization inherent to Islam would continue to reign. The efforts to create a caliphate spanning the globe aren't springing up from the grassroots of abandoned and impoverished desert populations. Rather, it springs fully formed from the men bearing suitcases of cash and ideological directives on what must be done and said to keep it coming. This money is coming from fundraisers in Qatar and Kuwait, and donors in those countries, as well as donors in Saudi Arabia, Bahrain, and beyond. If those donor networks were broken and permanently dismantled, it would break apart the emerging coalition of co-associating local movements subscribing to a hardline Islamic globalism. Yet, very little has been done by the leaders and partners of the so-called War on Terror to crack down on these ideological via financials networks and their backers, most of whom live in countries purporting officially to be a part of this War on Terror. We know who they are, and we understand the damage they're causing, and yet nothing changes. This is essentially as true today as it was in September 2001. True, there is no, quote, Muslim Pope who can command a unified reformation of Islam or even one of its major sects. But there are already plenty of Muslim scholars, Sunni imams, and other interpreters of holy text and Islamic law who are quite progressive and forward-thinking. In their quiet way, they have obtained the support of the vast majority of the faithful, those who have opposed the extremist acts supposedly committed in their names. Take, for example, the recently elevated Emir of Kano, one of the most significant semi-religious offices in Nigeria's predominantly Muslim north. Mohammed Sanusi II, formerly known as Sanusi Lamido Sanusi, used to be governor of the Central Bank of Nigeria. In stark contrast with groups like Boko Haram, Sanusi supports education for girls, ending child marriage, protecting women's rights, investment attraction for the North, a Marshall Plan for agricultural upgrades, and more. Moreover, he believes all of this is based in and required by his religion. Thus, it is not that modern and reform-minded Muslim leaders do not exist, but rather that they and their voluntary followers lack the reach and resources of the billionaire barons of bombings who supply arms, cash, and teachings to the disenfranchised and desperate young men from ocean to ocean. The Qatari, Kuwaiti, and Saudi terror kingpins have created their own reverse reform movement aimed at dragging Muslim populations and the entire world back to the dark. They have done this almost purely through the centralizing force of money, overcoming the natural tendencies of the diverse billion Sunni Muslims of the world. Investing in the goals and ideals of pro-reform networks would do a great deal to promote a centralized movement to continue moving into the future. We are often reminded that when Western Europe was at its darkest point, some 1,000 plus years ago. Scholars and scientists in the heart of the Muslim communities kept Western learning alive and moving forward. But it's worth remembering, too, that many of the countries or regions with Muslim populations now being threatened by regressive movements were often societies on the cutting edge of modernity as recently as half a century ago, even after their colonial struggles ended. There are many factors for the problem since decolonization. Indeed, many of the failures were as secular in origin as those in sub-Saharan Africa. But the financing networks influencing and spreading religious radicalism, more than any backwardness allegedly inherent to a faith, are a big key to why those countries continue to be held back and seized by violence. And that's all the time we have this week. Thanks for listening to Arsenal for Democracy. Tweet us your comments at AFDRadio or email AFDRadio@gmail.com. The show is available for download from ArsenalForDemocracy.com on Wednesdays. You can also hear it on the air in Delaware from 91.3 FM WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark every Wednesday night at 6 p.m. Eastern. Special thanks to my voiceover man, Justin. You can follow his work at the Digitized Ramblings of an 8-Bit Animal from 8BitAnimal.com. You can get additional commentary at ArsenalForDemocracy.com daily, as well as links to articles discussed today. From my studio in Newton, Massachusetts, I'm Bill Humphrey, and I approve this message. Good night.